You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon, no less than Deacon, also...
Also, what else? Did you drop out, Mark? I can't hear you. Am I on the air? Am I the only one on the air? Okay. So this is Deacon Stephen Gridanis coming to you for Mark Shea, and this is Connecting the Dots on Breadbox Media. And Mark has dropped out because live radio is so exciting. So I am here hosting by myself. I'm sure that Mark will be back in a few minutes, but until he comes back, I'm going to talk to you about whatever I feel like. And we're going to start out talking about a movie that is opening tomorrow in theaters called The Case for Christ. This is a drama, faith-based film based on the best-selling apologetical biography of Lee Strobel. Lee was a veteran journalist in the 1970s and 1980s for the Chicago Tribune. He was a kind of a hot shot when he started working in a newsroom when he was only 15 years old, and he published his first book when he was 28. He won awards. He was elevated to the legal editor for the Chicago Tribune, and he was a diehard atheist. Some of you may have read his book, and you may know the story. In 1979, his wife. Hi, I've just been holding forth here, so shall I keep going?
Sure, yes. Skype just chose that particular moment to just suddenly completely shut off and go away.
Well, we're talking about The Case for Christ.
Okay.
And I was just saying how Lee Strobel, hotshot journalist at the Chicago Tribune in the late 1970s and early 1980s, he was an atheist, and his life was going along just the way that he planned it until the day that his agnostic wife, Leslie, announced that she had become a Christian.
Okay.
And this really threw him for a loop. And he set out to use all of his journalistic and legal investigative skills to investigate the evidence for Jesus' resurrection.
Okay.
And how do you think that went, by the way?
I'm guessing from the title of the movie that it didn't go well for him as an atheist.
Yeah, that's right. And as a result, Lee Strobel, who published a book of this same title in 1998, which became a bestseller, he is now a very well-known apologist, popularizer of apologetical arguments of academics and scholars whom he interviews and puts their interviews in his books.
Okay.
And he's a pastor. And the film comes from PureFlix Entertainment, who are the people that brought us God's Not Dead.
Okay. And a less successful effort.
Well, see, this is the thing, is what happens when the people that made God's Not Dead set out to make The Case for Christ? And to answer that question, we need to talk about what's wrong with God's Not Dead and what's wrong with faith-based films generally.
Okay.
So have you seen either of the God's Not Dead films?
Or? I avoided them because I...
Good for you.
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Good movies. So take a good movie.
Right.
The Lord of the Rings, right?
Yes.
The Lord of the Rings, very good films. And here's what you never had to do with The Lord of the Rings. You never had to take out an ad campaign saying you should go see The Lord of the Rings to support... stories that have Catholic roots. you never had to do that because people went and saw The Lord of the Rings because it was a good movie. And they didn't have to have their arm twisted to go see it. And when I saw lots of campaigns saying, you must go see The Case for Christ because you owe it to Christian filmmaking to go see it because you're a Christian, I thought, this movie's got to be terrible.
Yeah, well, that's a good rule of thumb. I'm gonna push back on that just a little, though.
Okay.
Because this is something that happens, not necessarily – it does happen with – little bad films, but it also happens with little good films. It happens with little films generally because people who make little films are making films that they're passionate about. Nobody needs to sell The Lord of the Rings that way because it's a film with a gazillion-dollar budget and gazillion-dollar marketing and a fan base numbering in the gazillions.
Right.
And so it's going to make a gazillion dollars.
Well, okay, but okay, so Babette's Feast.
Right.
That. Nobody had to, like, twist my arm to go see Babette's Feast.
All right.
It was a little movie that, you know, it probably made a few million dollars. I don't know. But, you know, it was a great movie.
Yes. Okay.
I'll give you
Dolman. A couple counterexamples.
Okay.
Two of my favorite movies of 2016, my number one film and my number 10 film, were Patterson and Queen of Katwe. Mm-hmm. And these were both small movies that were made by passionate filmmakers. And unfortunately, Queen of Katwe significantly underperformed at the box office, which is a shame because it says to Disney, people don't want to see passionate movies like this. Mm-hmm. And Patterson is, you know, it's just a movie that people really need encouragement to see because it's not a movie that sells itself. So I have gone out there, you know, beating the hedges and saying to people, you really want to go see these movies and you'll be, you know, you'll be a better person for it. It will make you happy to see these movies.
And that's great word of mouth. I would call that terrific word of mouth advertising, and word of mouth advertising is really good. But your argument for the films was these are really good films.
Right.
And the arguments for things like God Is Not Dead are these are films that you should eat like you eat your spinach because you owe it to whoever, you know.
The scary thing about the God's Not Dead films, though, is that for the target audience, these were movies that told people exactly what they wanted to hear. They were the first God's Not Dead was a huge success on its own terms. It is, as a result, it's the film that PureFlix is best known for.
Okay.
And the reason that there are a couple reasons why it was so successful. My friend Peter Chataway has astutely pointed out that no, I'm thinking of a different movie. That was Son of God. Son of God came out at the same time as Noah. And so there was the kind of the resentment against Noah channeled into this is the religious movie that we're going to support. And that kind of pushed that made us. Was there another movie around the same time as God's Not Dead? Because God's Not Dead 2 was not as successful. Anyway.
Well, wasn't that around the same time that was it Christ the Lord out of Egypt? Came out, was that the same time?
As the original God's Not Dead? I don't think so. I think God's Not Dead.
I can't remember.
Anyway,
but I mean, the films became culture war proxies.
Yes.
You were, you know, if you went and saw God's Not Dead, then you were on one side of the culture war. And if you said anything nice about Noah, you were on the other side of the culture war, which is crazy.
Right. But the God's Not Dead films also really encapsulate a kind of paranoid, agonistic, evangelical slash fundamentalist urban legend view of the world in which evangelicals and fundamentalist Christians are the scorned, persecuted, hated of all society. And big atheism, which controls the culture, is against them and is trying to crush them underfoot and drive their faith out of the marketplace and out of public spaces. And believers and unbelievers are just natural enemies. And, you know, life is a battle to stand up for your faith.
It's a Manichaean war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, the believers in these movies are depicted as they've basically arrived and they have no flaws, and they, you know, then the atheists, they never do anything right. Mm-hmm. They're just evil and nasty, and then there are the characters who are the true seekers, and you can maybe group them with, you know, the good believers. Mm-hmm. But the case for Christ is nothing like any of that.
Good.
Yeah, this is a movie where there are atheists and non-believers who don't have horns and tails or mustaches for twirling and aren't out to crush believers into the dust or banish their beliefs from society. And the believers are not persecuted, marginalized victims. In fact, they're capable and respected professionals because, you know, Strobel goes around and he interviews all of these respected experts. And whether the, you know, you could, whoever it is, whatever their beliefs are, they're the top person in the field. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we get back, I want to hear more about that. I mean, is this one of these, is this a film where so-and-so plays himself, for example? I want to know that. Okay. We'll be back with Deacon Stephen Gardonis talking about The Case for Christ here on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis talking about life at the movies. And in particular, we're talking about The Case for Christ. It's based on Lee Strobel's book that came out about, well, almost 20 years ago now. And it was a book about events in his life that had taken place 20 years before that.
That's right. Yeah, it seems like every 20 years there's a new chapter in this story.
See what happens in you know, 2037 then. So he went and interviewed a lot of different people, and not cartoon characters, but actual, you know, real human beings. Are these is this a thing where we have actors? I'm guessing we have actors playing the people that he interviewed.
Yes, that's right. So, for instance, William Lane Craig, a New Testament scholar and philosopher, very, very well-known apologist.
Right.
Gary Habermas, another well-known New Testament scholar and apologist, both appear in the film, and they were, you know, it was the real William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas back in 1979, 1980, when he was doing these interviews, but they have actors playing them now.
Okay.
So nobody in the movie is playing themselves, because nobody still looks like they did 20 years ago. Because
old now.
Well, because he did not, in fact, interview Patrick Stewart. If he had interviewed Patrick Stewart, he could play himself, because the man never changes. But
That's true.
There are also characters in the movie who are, as they say, composites or fictional stand-ins for the kind of people that he talked to and the kinds of conversation that they had. Faye Dunaway is in this movie. She has a cameo as a professor of psychology who is an agnostic and is brought in to poo-poo the mass hallucination theory of the resurrection.
Okay. Well, and Dunaway is herself a Catholic convert.
I did not know that.
Yes.
So that's very interesting.
So, yeah, there you go.
Since you mentioned the Catholic angle on this film, I should say that one of the odd things about God's Not Dead is a really weird anti-Catholic ellipsis in the film. You wouldn't know it watching the film unless you happened to know who Monsignor Georges Lemaitre is, and I know that you do.
I do.
Georges Lemaitre is the father of the Big Bang Theory. He is also a Catholic priest, a Belgian priest physicist. And in the film, the young evangelical protagonist is trying to argue that science and faith are not antithetical. And he cites the fact that the Big Bang was first posited by Georges Lemaitre. And he calls him a theist. And before he can, it seems like he's going to say something else, like maybe, in fact, he was a Catholic priest, but he's interrupted. Now, I happen to know that the screenwriters of God's Not Dead are, I think they're a pair of brothers. They're Catholic, and they had it in the screenplay that he was a Catholic priest, but the director and the producers took it out. They wouldn't even identify him as a Catholic or a priest. That's how utterly unwilling the makers of God's Not Dead were to even marginally jostle the sensibilities of their fundamentalist audience.
Holy moly. You know, it's really, I had John Farrell on my show a couple months back.
Yes.
John Farrell is the author of a book called The Day Without Yesterday. And it's a biography of Monsignor Georges Lemaitre. And, one of the things that we talked about was the fact that one of the oddities of apologetics like that that you get from fundamentalists is you know fundamentalism is still the home of, you know, well, evolution is, you know, it's all a lie and et cetera, et cetera. And what's always meant by that is biological evolution. Biological evolution is all a lie. But then immediately when we turn to arguments between fundamentalists and, you know, people like the villain in God's Not Dead, the appeal is made, well, we're not anti-science. And here, and the people that they trot out are always going to be people like Monsignor Lemaitre and Isaac Newton, or, you know, take your pick. I mean, there's a number of people you can appeal to. Gregor Mendel also always gets a mention. And yet, of course, what Georges Lemaitre did was essentially expand the theory of evolution beyond the biological sphere to the entire universe and say, here's how the universe evolved from what he called the cosmic egg to the universe that we see before us today.
Right. And billions and billions of years ago, he wasn't able to pin it down to 14 point whatever or 13 point whatever, but he knew that it was many billions of years old.
A lot years older than 6,000 years and
right.
Not made in 7 days. And that's the whole point of what Lemaitre has to say. And yet he gets trotted out as, look, we're not anti-science. And so we were both just, I'm perpetually amused by that the people who are most doggedly opposed to the theory of evolution are also happy to trot out Lemaitre, who basically turned the theory of evolution into an entire cosmology, And also Gregor Mendel, who is the guy who more than anybody provided the engine that explained what Darwin could not explain as to how living things change.
So what's interesting, though, about the case for Christ is that they've actually gone in the other direction. There's no indication, at least in Strobel's book, that any of the scholars that he talked to were Catholic. The only people that he lists are evangelicals.
Okay.
But and maybe he did talk to Catholic experts, but they didn't find their way into his book. At any rate, in the film, he goes to see a top archaeologist turned member of the clergy, and it's a Catholic priest. And we find him in a very lovely old Catholic church, which I looked up online, and it turns out that it's St. Vincent de Paul Church in Los Angeles, which has been in a number of other movies. And so the actor Miguel Perez plays this priest whose name is Jose Maria Marquez. So they've given him a very Catholic name. And mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting. And they even give him the opportunity to defend the Catholic Church's tradition and architecture. He's fundamentally there to make the argument that the New Testament records as we have them are very reliable and very well attested to what was originally written in the first century. So he joins – each of the scholars is there to make one point. So the New Testament records are highly reliable. The earliest record of the resurrection goes back to a very short period of time after the actual resurrection of Jesus. Right. The New Testament writers and those who knew Jesus personally had no reason to lie about Jesus being raised from the dead because they suffered and many of them were martyred for it.
Right.
Jesus was definitely buried. His body was not fed to wild dogs. So there was a specific tomb and the tomb was empty. And so on and so forth. We can't explain this by a swoon theory. We can't explain this by mass hallucination and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, I wouldn't say it's a great film, but it's a film that allows people of different opinions to be smart and thoughtful people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't have this persecution complex worldview of the God's Not Dead films. And the characters, the relationship between Lee and his wife comes across as a fairly real and human relationship. When they argue, they sound like intelligent adults who love each other but are having an argument, and there's the kind of give and take where you say something and the other person takes it the wrong way and you say, I didn't mean that. And all these kinds of things that just make a movie watchable instead of being excruciating. Okay. I mean, that's – when I put it like that, it sounds like it's a really low bar. And okay, I admit God's Not Dead is about the lowest bar that there is. But the improvement is not marginal. Let's just say that.
The case for Christ, not excruciating. I get you. I get you. Yeah. It sounds like it would be a useful movie. An RCIA class or whatever, although maybe not an RCIA class, but some kind of religious ed thing. You know, if you want to discuss arguments for the resurrection, because a lot of people, you know, don't know the first thing about the New Testament. And so it's a decent place to start. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We have been talking about The Case for Christ, and we'll be back to talk about more Life at the Movies right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. Thanks to Danny Head, who remembers things better than I do. It was brought back to me yesterday. Rod and I were talking, the movie we were talking about, actually the series we were talking about, was Pirates of the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
And we both agreed that we liked the first Pirates of the Caribbean, and the series could have stopped with one, but although the second one was pretty good, but
the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I don't want to get sidetracked on this because we need to talk about Ghost in the Shell, but just very briefly, the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie belongs to that class of movies which has brilliant stuff in it, and. But it doesn't tie itself together, and it needs another movie to kind of wrap it up. And when the third movie – so it's the kind of movie that when you see the threequel, it makes the sequel retroactively worse. This is a real thing that happens, and I can give other examples. But
okay.
We'll talk about that another time.
We'll talk about that another time. But
yes.
Okay. So Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell. I have two pieces on this. I have a movie review and also an essay called Ghosts and Shells: Is Transhumanism Cartesian? And this is why I will never really be great at Twitter. Because to be great at Twitter, you need to have a knack. You need to have an ear for the catchy headline, the clickbait, the question that makes people need to know the answer. And, you know, is transhumanism Cartesian? Yeah, it's just not grabbing the masses and dragging them to my website. I don't know why, but whatever the knack is, I just don't have it.
So next week, Stephen Gardonis talks about eating your spinach and why it's exciting.
So Ghost in the Shell is based on a very successful and influential Japanese media franchise. It started out as a manga graphic novel and became an anime and then an anime series. And it is set in a dystopian future where people are cybernetically enhanced to one degree or another. People have devices implanted into their bodies, into their heads. It expands their cognitive abilities. It lets you to talk to people without having to pick up a device and so forth. And then there is the Major, who is played in the film by Scarlett Johansson. And she has what they're calling a full body prosthesis. And this isn't like Tony Stark's armor. This is, she's got a human brain in a completely synthetic robot body.
Okay. The brain in the jar.
Except
the jar is really pretty hot.
Right, right. Yeah. And you know, it can kickboxing and jump off of buildings, and it has this turning invisible shielding thing that happens. And it's all set in a nightmarish world that's a little bit like Tokyo or Hong Kong by way of Blade Runner's Los Angeles. It's a movie that asks questions about the nature of humanity, and the underlying franchise is all about the idea of transhumanism, the idea that we can improve ourselves through technology. We can move past the weaknesses of our biological state and potentially even put our biology entirely behind us. The Major comes close to realizing this ideal, but she's still got her human brain in there, which remains her one real vulnerability. I mean, to really transcend, we would need to do what Johnny Depp does in the aptly named Transcendence, which is completely upload your consciousness into a computer system. And then, you know, that's the true resurrection from the dead in according to the gospel of transhumanism.
Right. Yeah. Michael Flynn has described it as the eschaton for nerds.
Yes.
So, yeah. So anyway, continue.
You know, I interviewing even a bad movie, a movie that I don't like, and there are a lot of things not to like about this movie. I saw this movie with Suzanne, and this is the kind of movie where she turns to me during the movie with this kind of icy glare, and she's
you
not gonna
made me watch this.
Yes, yes. She's like, when can we escape this nightmare? Just because it's so unpleasant and there's so much violence and it's such a horrible world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there's the fact that the characters aren't, not only are they not likable, they aren't well developed, they aren't interesting. You can see, and then the themes aren't developed in any particularly interesting way either. And really, Ghost in the Shell, the live action movie, is about trying to overwhelm you with visual razzle dazzle, but in an ugly mode rather than a beautiful mode like James Cameron's Avatar. And then also, which also has a certain element of transhumanism in it. Mm-hmm. But then also it's very much about brand identity. It's about trying to connect with fans of a franchise and establish a new franchise on the back of the existing one. And that's, you know, that's just not a formula for a great film.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things not to like about Ghost in the Shell, but it, even when I don't like a movie, it always offers interesting fodder, not always, but sometimes, to think about the themes that it doesn't address or that it touches on or that somebody at some point in the creative process was interested in but never quite made it to the screen. But you can see that there was an interesting thought there at one point.
You might say it's the ghost in the screenplay.
Well, exactly. In fact, people have said that.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't put that in my review. Because
dang, I was so clever.
Well, you know, one of the things that occurred to me thinking about the movie is just how it, on the one hand, it combines a real coldly reductionistic materialism, the idea that everything is reducible to subatomic particles and physical processes and biochemistry and electricity and physical forces and so forth. There is nothing mystical or supernatural about the human person. But then in this incarnation, we're also dealing with this idea of the ghost in the shell, that And the ghost here, your ghost, your spirit, your essence, your personality is connected in this world with your brain. So you need your brain to have your spirit. But then that does elevate you above machines because a robot doesn't have a human's passion or intuition. And so and I think that that kind of dichotomy or tension is fundamental to at least the extreme version of the transhumanist worldview, because if you're going to be Johnny Depp and upload yourself into a computer, then on the one hand you have the idea that, you know, we can completely replicate everything that's happening in your brain inside a computer network. But then there's also this mystical idea, which is that, you know, if we shut down your body and we then you wake up inside the computer, that's really you. It's not a copy of you, like if you copy a program from one disk to another. It's not the same copy. It's not the same file. It's a copy of the file. Mm-hmm. And people have this, I think, kind of confused idea that if we upload you into the computer and then inside the computer, there's thought going on based on your brain waves and your memories and so forth, that somehow you've achieved immortality. And, you know, I hate to disillusion people, but, you know, you think about what if we didn't destroy your body and you're still inside yourself, and then, okay, now you can clearly see what's inside the computer is not you. It's it's a copy.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the – this is really getting outre, but one of the long-standing discussions among Star Trek people, you know, and you actually saw it discussed in another way in a film called, which you've probably seen, called The Prestige.
You're actually exactly echoing my piece.
Oh, okay.
but go on.
Yeah, well, you know, the among Star Trek nerds was the discussion of what does a transporter do exactly?
Right.
Does it destroy you and then just make a replica of you, or is that you that reappears on the planet? And the, you know, it all comes back to the Gnostic notion that somehow you're more pure. The essence of you has been distilled like a fine liquor. Once you clear the body away, then you're getting at who you really are. And I think, you know, being even more nerdly, that there's the awful robots in Doctor Who may point to an entirely different idea, that if you take the body away, you've maimed a person and you've damaged them. This is what the resurrection is about. The union of body and spirit. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, and we are also talking about the movies. And we're going to talk about a brand new film now, right?
you said in an earlier segment that you were interested in talking about old movies, and you gave Pirates of the Caribbean as an example of an old movie, and
old man.
Well, I thought let's take the end of our segment here to talk about a genuinely old movie, and a movie that everyone listening should either have seen, or you should go and read my new essay at Catholic Digest. You can also get to it from decentfilms.com, and then go see it, because it really is one of the great films. It is one of the honorees on the Vatican film list. 1995, it's one of the 45 films, 15 films in the category of art. And it is by a filmmaker with a very famous artist's name, Renoir. He is, Jean Renoir is the son of the Impressionist painter. And he is best known for this film, Grand Illusion, and for another film which he made 2 years later called Rules of the Game. And of the two, they're both masterpieces. They're both absolutely brilliant. Of the two, I somewhat prefer Grand Illusion. And what both of these films are about in a way is a kind of a passing away of old Europe. It's about the Europe that was up to and to a certain extent through and after the First World War, and the Europe that was passing away in the build-up to World War II, and that really definitively came to an end in World War II.
Yeah.
So it's a World War, it's a film that's set in World War One, and it is probably the gentlest, most humane, most hopeful, politest war movie that has ever been made.
Okay.
This is a movie where, and you know, of course it depends on the particular soldiers and their particular scenario, but it's about an aristocratic officer who has a very kind of urbane view on the world. He is von Rothenstein, played by Eric von Stroheim, who is both a great director and a great actor. And he's an aristocrat, he's an officer, he's a German. And when he captures enemy officers, you know, he regards them as his equals. And so he treats them with courtesy and respect, particularly those who are aristocrats, you know. And then, of course, it turns out that these people, you know, they have friends in common. it's almost like a social thing, this kind of capturing of enemy officers. But then you realize, well, first of all, I mean, this isn't all that surprising because this is happening in Western Europe at a time when all of Western Europe is Christian, and you know, it's just not that big a piece of real estate. This is before the rise of Nazism and you know the first truly post-Christian Western European power. But in spite of everything that unites these enemies. That's something that we've seen before also in movies about like the Christmas truce, right?
Right, right, yeah.
There are other lines that divide them. There's the lines between aristocrat and non-aristocrat, between the rich and the poor, Gentile and Jew.
Right.
And the way that the film kind of negotiates these, and you know, empathy is extended, and people bond across these lines, you can really feel Renoir offering. He's kind of pleading with the people of his world to affirm that which unites us, and not to go in the direction that 2 years later, when he made Rules of the Game, it was pretty obvious that the world was definitely going.
When was Grand Illusion made?
1937.
Okay, yeah.
So there was still hope at that point that World War II right. might be averted.
Yeah, yeah. The Czechoslovakia had not yet been taken, and the Anschluss hadn't happened. Germany had occupied the Rhineland. But I think at that point, a lot of people were thinking, well, they should get the Rhineland back. There was a lot of guilt in the West over how Germany had been treated.
Yes.
After the war, but yeah, it's okay. You know, I've never seen The Grand Illusion, and it makes me want to see it now. I can probably find it on Amazon or something. Maybe I'll go see if I can find that. I did not know that Jean Renoir was the son of the painter.
Yes, yes.
So that shows you how ignorant I am of my film lore. So just. Another thing to lament. Can you tell me about the Rules of the Game? I don't know anything about that.
I have seen it, and I talk about it in my review. I do a little comparison contrast. At this point, because this essay, I'm going to tell you a little trade secret. It just went up on Catholic Digest, but I actually wrote nearly all of it quite some time ago.
Okay.
So I haven't seen Rules of the Game lately, but I can say that there's an interesting contrast between these two films. Neither quite fits the genre that it seems to be. Rules of the Game is something like a comedy of manners or a bedroom farce, and Grand Illusion is something of a war film. But
okay.
Grand Illusion is a war film that doesn't have any actual battle scenes or anything, you know, that you associate with. It's an anti-war film, not just in the sense that it's okay. anti-war, but that it's an anti-war film, if you follow me.
Right.
The same way, Rules of the Game has been called a tragedy of manners. It's a bitter, satiric, angry film made by a filmmaker who at this point was despairing for his world.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you knew this, but there was actually a book written in 1913 by a guy named Norman Angel called The Grand Illusion. And what Angel said in 1913 was there will never be a huge continental war in Europe. Because, well, if that were to happen, that would destroy the entire socioeconomic fabric of Europe and millions of people would die. That would be insane. Who would do that? And there was tremendous, you know, this weird confidence among some people. Andrew Carnegie famously said that Western civilization was held together by, quote, the sacred bonds of commerce, unquote.
The meaning of the title is a little obscure. People have debated what exactly is the Grand Illusion, and you can't help thinking of it in the last scene as you have one or more characters. I don't want to completely spoil it, but you have characters who live rather than die because at a certain moment in time, they're deemed to be on the right side of an imaginary line in the middle of absolutely nowhere, natural world that, you know, the line doesn't exist. It's part of a made-up world of human rules, along with that line between nobility and commoners, or rich and the poor, Jews and Gentiles, allied and central powers.
Right.
And so what I think it ultimately comes down to is that it's these illusions that we align ourselves with when we pit ourselves against each other, and when we fight, and when we hate, and when we kill. And seeing through the Grand Illusion, I think, is about coming to recognize how essential it is to have empathy, and how precious and fragile happiness is, and how grateful we ought to be if we have the privilege of living out our lives in a state of comparative peace and freedom, as you and I do.
Yeah. And God grant that we continue to do so. I am going to go find that, and I'm going to watch it. So, see, you have made another customer for the Grand Illusion,
and that really is the best part of my job. And I love writing the savage reviews. I love tearing apart bad movies. And there's something very gleeful and cathartic about when a person writes to me and says, "Thank you for saying everything that was horrible about that movie. I feel so much better." But the real reward is when people say, "Thank you for introducing me to
God's not dead."
God.
Sorry.
Well, let's see. We're just going to leave it right. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is. Yeah, it is a great feeling, when you get people turned on to something like that. So thank you for that. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today was Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Our producer was Mr. Danny Head, the man with a better memory than me. And I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a glorious evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.